The headlines: Russia says it will take countermeasures in response to Finland and Sweden joining the U.S.-led NATO military alliance. A group of lawmakers in the European Union calls on the bloc to hold Israel accountable for the murder of Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh. And Australia joins the U.S., Canada, and several European countries in detecting cases of the monkeypox, a rare disease caused by a virus.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Russia's defense minister has pledged, quote, adequate countermeasures against Finland and Sweden's NATO membership. Sergei Shoigu says that the two Nordic countries joining NATO has led to an increase in military threats near the border. He said Russia would respond by forming 12 new units in its western military district. Finland and Sweden formally applied to join the Western Military Alliance on Wednesday. One Russian retaliatory measure involves cutting the export of gas. Finnish state-owned energy company says the flow of Russian gas to neighboring Finland would stop on Saturday morning. Gazprom has, however, assured its customers that it will not disrupt the gas transmission network and supplies will continue from other sources in the coming months. U.S. President Joe Biden has met with Finland and Sweden leaders at the White House, voicing support for the two countries joining NATO. Biden said Finland and Sweden would make NATO stronger and enhance its security. The two Nordic states have offered their bids to join the Western Military Alliance. Following Russia's war in Ukraine, they have pushed ahead with their plans despite Russia's warning of retaliatory steps. Meanwhile, Turkey is opposed to Sweden and Finland's membership in NATO. Ankara wants them to lift their bans on some arms sales to Turkey. Ankara also wants Stockholm to stop backing Kurdish Workers' Party, the PKK. Kurdish labels the PKK as a terror group. Sweden and Finland need the approval of all 30 members of NATO to be able to join the alliance. Global food shortages triggered by the conflict in Ukraine have drastically pushed up prices. The severe supply shortfalls could mean mass hunger in future if serious measures are not taken now.
A food basket for the world. That's how Ukraine has been described for many years. It produces commodities like wheat, corn, and sunflower oil, not just for its own population, but also for people in the rest of Europe and far beyond. Ukraine has long been known for its fertile plains, and its farmland is cheaper to run than in the rest of Europe and the United States. Meanwhile, Ukraine's Black Sea ports give it easy access to international markets. The combination has made the Eastern European country a major exporter of many agricultural commodities and the world's number one exporter of sunflower oil. Food products made from Ukrainian cereals, such as corn and wheat, can be found in markets and kitchens around the world. But Ukraine's exports have collapsed over the past few months due to the war with neighboring Russia. The disruption to Ukrainian exports is sending shockwaves through the region and the rest of the world, with food prices surging to record highs. There have been many warnings that the situation could have a devastating impact. This week, Secretary General of the United Nations, Antonio Guterres, raised the alarm. The UN chief warned that a war could soon cause a global food crisis that may last for years. The warning comes as a conflict has cut off supplies from Ukraine's ports. The UN Secretary General said the conflict has worsened food insecurity in poorer nations due to surging prices of commodities. The latest warning comes as Russia and the West trade blame for the conflict, which doesn't seem to be ending anytime soon.
The UN chief has warned about the impact of shortages of grain and fertilizer caused by the war in Ukraine, climate change, and COVID-19-related supply problems. Guterres says the situation threatens the push tens of millions of people into food insecurity, followed by mass hunger and famine.
Time seems to be running out fast for the world to take measures to avert a full-blown international food crisis. According to the United Nations, global food prices are already 30% higher than the same time last year, and experts are warning that the situation could worsen very fast if it goes unchecked. The severe shortages due to the conflict in Ukraine are triggering leaders of other countries to turn to food protectionism, putting further strains on global food markets. Food prices climbed higher last week after India banned wheat exports. New Delhi argues that the curbs are essential for its own food security and also for keeping domestic prices in check. The UN chief warns that the only effective solution to the crisis is restoring Ukraine's food production and fertilizer production by both Russia and Belarus. The UN Secretary General says he is in intense contact with Russia and Ukraine, as well as the US and the EU, in a bid to restore food exports back to normal levels. Around 20 million tons of grain are currently stuck in Ukraine from last year's harvest, which, if released, could ease pressure on global markets. Antonio Guterres says overcoming the current tough situation requires goodwill on all sides. The chaos is widely blamed on the geopolitical rivalry between the West, mainly the United States, and the Russian Federation. Will they learn a lesson from the devastating impact of their tug-of-war in Ukraine?
This could have been avoided, but this was not done because we know that, of course, NATO has been expanding eastwards and keeps prodding Russia and keeps wanting to engage. And now they're asking for more and more weapons, so they want to step up and escalate the situation, which is very, very dangerous and could lead even to World War III. It could lead to a nuclear global war. So more people should be aware of the severity of the situation.
Lawmakers in the European Union have called on EU authorities to hold Israel accountable for the number of Palestinian journalists sharing Abu Akleh. The atrocity has just been debated, and the European Parliament, Jerome Hughes, reports.
Once again, crimes committed by the Israeli regime have been debated in the European Parliament. Lawmakers condemned the brutal murder on the 11th of May of Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. She was shot in the head by an Israeli soldier.
Too often we, here in Europe, look away when the spiral of violence continues, when new settlements plans are announced, or when another journalist gets killed or wounded.
Clearly wearing press attire, 51-year-old Abu Akleh was murdered in cold blood while covering an Israeli military raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. During her funeral, Israeli forces attacked mourners.
The European Union is appalled by the events that took place during the funeral procession. The EU condemned this disproportionate use of force and disrespectful behaviour.
Western media and Western leaders have been accused of turning a blind eye to the international law violations continuously perpetrated by the apartheid Israeli regime in the occupied territories.
Increased settler violence around the settlements, clashes at the holy sites in Jerusalem during the Ramadan, forced evictions and demolitions in the West Bank, including of EU-funded projects.
Tel Aviv has been urged to fully cooperate with an independent inquiry into Shireen's murder. The EU says that's important in order to maintain the bloc's close partnership with Israel.
When situations like this arise, we say it is very important for this partnership to continue in its high quality, that we have clarity about things that are happening, which are actually against our principles and our values.
EU legislators urge the West not to give up on the idea of a two-state solution to end the Israel-Palestine conflict.
The tragic death of Shireen Abu Akleh is a sad reminder of the spiral of violence taking place that continues to haunt this region.
The European Parliament debate heard that Israel has killed around 50 Palestinian journalists during the past two decades. It goes without saying then that Shireen was not the first and almost certainly will not be the last. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
UK-based pro-Palestine activist group has taken the fight to Israel's biggest arms manufacturer in Britain by launching a series of direct action protests at sites belonging to the drone producer Elbit Systems. Palestine Action have vowed further action in response to the ongoing support Elbit provides the Israeli regime in oppressing innocent Palestinians. Robert Carter reports.
A UK-based Israeli arms manufacturer has been hit with a series of disruptive direct action protests in retaliation to recent Israeli aggression against Palestinians. Palestine Action have intensified their long-running campaign against Elbit Systems, with activists trashing sites in London and Bristol.
Elbit Systems is a notorious Israeli arms manufacturer with locations dotted all across the UK. Their HQ, located just behind me, is a popular target for Palestine Action, who claim that their activities is focused on disrupting their production activities. Elbit is known for producing up to 85% of Israel's drone fleet, after all.
Israeli crimes against Palestinians has circulated world headlines in recent weeks, particularly surrounding the killing of journalist Shireen Abu Akhila, shot dead by Israeli regime forces as she documented an Israeli assault on a Palestinian refugee camp on the 11th of May. The killing occurred just days before the Nakba, an annual date which marks the ethnic cleansing of native Palestinians from their homeland. Elbit's recent response stated,
Elbit Systems UK is proud to provide advanced support for the UK armed forces. Attempting to disrupt this work during a time of heightened global instability is dangerous and highly irresponsible.
The activists rubbish Elbit's stance.
How many lives have they saved compared to how many lives they've taken, would be my question. They are responsible for so many deaths of men, women and children. How could you possibly think that that's in any way security? It's illegal, it's a crime. All of these things are criminal, and yet it's when you're out there doing something that you're shown as the criminal, essentially. And I've always found that very interesting as a narrative.
With Palestine Action vowing to continue and Israel's occupation persisting, many expect to see more spilling of red paint, but also more Palestinian blood too. Robert Carter, London.
Australia has reported its first case of monkeypox, a disease caused by a virus which is a member of the same family of viruses as smallpox. Australia detected the case in a man who recently arrived in Melbourne from Britain. Two of the infected patients in the UK had traveled from Nigeria. Other European countries, including France, Spain, Italy, Portugal, as well as the US and Canada, have confirmed cases too. Monkeypox was first recorded in the Democratic Republic of the Congo in the 1970s. It is now common in Western and Central Africa. The disease spreads through a very close contact with an infected person. It can enter the body through broken skin, eyes, nose, and the mouth. The symptoms include fever, headaches, and skin rashes. A police officer in the U.S. city of Chicago shot and wounded an unarmed 13-year-old boy 2 days ago. Now, the Civilian Oversight Agency of Chicago Police Department says that they have launched a probe into the incident.
We're not going to speculate. This investigation will reveal the facts. COPA will do a thorough investigation with our department's full support. If we're going to jump to conclusions and not conduct an investigation, then shame on us all. So we have to conduct a thorough investigation. The officer will make statements. This young man will make statements. We'll go through all the video. We'll consider all the evidence, ballistic evidence.
Police say the boy was suspected of taking part in a carjacking that took place on Tuesday. That is the day before the boy was shot. Police found the car involved and the carjacking stopped it. And after that, the boy fled. Then officers chased him and shot him on foot. That shot was turned towards the officers, and according to Chicago police, some local media say the boy was shot in the back. Details remain unknown, as police say that they cannot release the footage because it involves an unidentified person. New Delhi has ordered shopkeepers in Indian-controlled Kashmir to install CCTV systems at their own expense. Authorities say the move is necessary to protect people's lives. However, activists say the measure legitimizes a complete surveillance of their civic life. Shana Butt reports.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, a recent order by the authorities is giving sleepless nights to many business owners and shopkeepers. Business owners, big and small, are spending hundreds of dollars each to install security cameras, a mandatory move ordered by the authorities. The official order says the scheme will deter criminals, antisocial and anti-national elements. The order also outlines the minimum standards for camera resolution, infrared capability and range. The government's order has been highly criticized by business owners. They describe the move as a callous approach towards warrior Kashmir's fractured business establishments, which were deeply dented after India cancelled Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019.
Everybody knows the quantum of the business, it's almost 80% down. It was their duty to install the CC camera. Why to tell to the business community you install the CCTV cameras? You see, the 80% of the business community, they cannot afford to install this CCTV camera. So I think they should review this decision and they should look into this.
Muzaffar Jan, a shop owner in the heart of Srinagar's busiest market, Lal Chowk, says it has been days since he has seen a customer at his store. However, to follow the police instructions, he was forced to pull out the money he had saved for running his household.
I waited for around a week to see whether others would install cameras. Later, I was forced because of continuous announcements and strict orders. I installed the camera. It took me around $1,000 and not everyone can afford this cost. In Kashmir, there are frequent power cuts and to keep the camera plugged in, I had to install an uninterrupted power supply inverter. Many of us can't manage two meals a day. How can we afford these cameras?
The order further instructs that the cameras installed at the business owner's expense must always stay on. The system should record and store footage for 30 days and must be produced on demand of police and other law enforcement agencies without any court order. And failure to abide by the order will result in a fine or month-long imprisonment. The level of surveillance in Kashmir is increasing day by day. Authorities argue that the measure will help them protect people's lives. But Kashmiris are calling the move as a worrying development and see it as a threat to their human rights, privacy and dignity. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The list of U.S. crimes against humanity is long and unending, and is not confined to the terrorism of American military forces during the Second World War. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Kahan International Staff Writer. This article is published under the heading, Racist Terrorism Rules the U.S. Here's the story. What happened recently in the city of Buffalo, where a teenage white-skinned terrorist sadistically slaughtered a dozen people because of dark color of their skin, has once again shocked the civilized world. But it failed to thaw a frozen racist conscience of the U.S., especially the Zionist-controlled clique that rules it. Such killings of the innocent have been regular occurrences in American history since 1660, starting with the European settlers' organized genocide of the Native Amerindians, the so-called Redskins, and has impacted almost every ethnic and racial group in the United States, especially the black people who were kidnapped from Africa and enslaved in the New World. Native Amerindians, who were forced off their lands and relocated to the so-called reservations, have almost become extinct. According to historical evidence, in the second half of the 19th century, within a space of a mere 2 years during the Gold Rush, over 100,000 natives were massacred in California, whose then governor, Peter Burnett, had infamously said, "The war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Red Indian race becomes extinct." Until a century ago, before the First World War, the U.S. state and federal governments used to pay millions of dollars to white racist militias to murder the Amerindians. This Ku Klux Klan, or KKK, mentality next saw programs against Chinese Americans in the Pacific Northwest, where they were rounded up and expelled from towns under threat of mob rule, while the mistreatment of the Afro-Americans intensified. Thus today, while verbally deploring the frequent killing of the black people by both the white terroristic police force and non-state terrorists, such as Peyton S. Gendron, who carried out the Buffalo Massacre, the state has resorted to the illegal detention of black Americans, increasing the number of incarcerations in the nation's prison system from 300,000 in 1980 to around 3 million at present. In view of these undeniable facts, the crocodile tears shed by President Joe Biden over the recent incidents will neither soothe the broken hearts of the colored citizens nor will end the murderous discriminations against them. After all, this racist, terroristic mentality is ingrained in the top echelons of the so-called White House that was built with black labor and had manifested itself in the person of that hardcore criminal called Donald Trump and his team of murderers who acted with open impudence at both home and abroad, as was proven during the mass uprising of the Afro-Americans during his presidency, and his target killing of the famous anti-terrorism Iranian general Qasem Soleimani. In short, the list of U.S. crimes against humanity is long and unending, and is not confined to the terrorism of American military forces during the Second World War against the conquered Japanese or the subdued European peoples of Germany and Italy, who were mass murdered and their women gang raped. It is also not limited to the My Lai mass massacre of over 500 unarmed Vietnamese civilians, including women and children, on March 16, 1968, neither to the Dasht-e Leili massacre in December 2001 in Afghanistan, when some 2,000 prisoners were shot or suffocated to death in metal shipping containers, nor to the Nisour Square massacre in Baghdad on September 16, 2007, as part of the U.S. killing of over 1.2 million Iraqi people.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wa salam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى ابن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners, and I'm your host, Mahdi. We're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led a life which was in balance and harmony with that of the Prophet Muhammad, his great-great-grandfather. His life and the life of Imam al-Kazim was in the line and the direction of the Prophet Muhammad. And of course, the life of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam was a strict adherence and obedience of Islam in so many different ways, whether it was his ethics, his morals, his behaviors, his actions, his statements. We find that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the copy of the Holy Prophet Muhammad of Islam, the messenger of Allah. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam led an upright, righteous, and noble life. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام عليكم بالدعاء فإن الدعاء لله والطلب إلى الله يرد البلاء وقد قدر وقضي ولم يبق إلا إمضاؤه فإذا دعي الله عز وجل وسئل صرف البلاء صرفه.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, I urge you to supplicate, for verily supplication to Allah and seeking from Allah repels calamity, which may have been destined and decreed, with just the execution remaining. So if Allah is supplicated and is asked to avert a calamity, it is averted.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when we look at the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam, we find that His Eminence taught His companions and spoke to His companions about a concept called ad-du'a, supplication. And so in these du'a and these supplications, we find that Imam al-Kadhim teaches his companions in this form of a dialogue on how exactly to pray to Allah and how exactly to address Allah. Now, these du'as in themselves have a very deep and profound meaning as well. In one instance, in this dialogue where Imam al-Kadhim was teaching his companion on how to do dua and what to say in a dua, Imam al-Kadhim, while addressing Allah, says, "You, O Allah, know what I conceal, and you, O Allah, know what I make public." In our lives, dear friends, this seems to be one of the great keys to success and prosperity upon our path of Islam. If only we realize and understand that the Almighty Allah knows what we conceal, meaning whatever we think, whatever we have in our hearts, whether it is greed or lust or carnal desires or hate or anger or jealousy, Allah knows it all. And so is it not embarrassing for us to realize that there are these kind of wicked, evil, lowly things in our hearts, and yet Allah is aware of them? And so, of course, we ask for forgiveness from Allah, that may He not only purify these evil characteristics and attributes from our hearts, but may Allah, the Merciful, forgive these faults within our heart. And of course, we as an individual must work hard towards improving these aspects of ourselves. And not only this, when we address the oppressors of the world and the bullies of the world, whether on a local, domestic level or on a national or even global level, they must remember that Allah knows what is public. Allah knows what is happening, and He is the ultimate judge, and He will surely judge those who do wrong, and He will surely judge those who do right. And Almighty Allah, the Creator of all of existence, will punish those who do wrong, and He will reward all those who do right. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
When you look at the time of the seventh Imam, you know, he also actually lived in the circumstances of taqiyya more than any of the Imams before him. And I'll just give you one example that when it comes to the situation of the seventh Imam, all the Imams who came before, still, they lived at a time where it was possible for them to publicly announce their successor, at least among the Shia community. But by the days, last days of the sixth Imam, it became so difficult. And this is amazing that now you have Banu Abbas. The Hashemid rulers are there, not Umayyads. But they were more cruel in a way. Things have become so bad that the sixth Imam realized that if we disclose who is my heir and successor publicly, you know, Banu Abbas, they are actually looking for who will be my successor, and they will eliminate him. So what Imam did was, besides, you know, talking to his old close companions and letting them know about our seventh Imam, he actually wrote a will which was to be opened and publicly pronounced so everybody would know about it. And that's where you see our sixth Imam uses what we call Tawriya.
Listening to this episode of Dialogue, don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Gun production in the United States has skyrocketed, with newly released data showing a shift in popularity from long guns used for hunting to handguns for personal protection. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Glenn Thrush. The piece is titled, U.S. Gun Production Tripled Since 2000. Fueled by handgun purchases. A The United States is in the middle of a great gun buying boom that shows no sign of letting up as the annual number of firearms manufactured has nearly tripled since 2000 and spiked sharply in the past 3 years, according to the first comprehensive federal tally of gun commerce in the last 2 decades in the U.S. The report released by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives on Tuesday, 17th of May, 3 days after a mass shooting in Buffalo, New York, left 10 people dead, painted a vivid statistical portrait of a nation arming itself to the teeth. Buyers capitalized on the loosening of gun restrictions by the U.S. Supreme Court, Congress, and Republican-controlled state legislatures. The data documented a drastic shift in consumer demand among gun owners that has had profound commercial, cultural, and political implications. Starting in 2009, Glock-type semi-automatic handguns purchased for personal protection began to outsell rifles, which have been typically used in hunting. Embedded in the 306-page document was another statistic that law enforcement officials find especially troubling. The police recovered 19,344 privately manufactured firearms, untraceable homemade weapons known as ghost guns, in 2021, a tenfold increase since 2016. Law enforcement officials say that has contributed to the surge in gun-related killings, especially in California, where ghost guns make up as many as half of weapons recovered at crime scenes. The numbers released on Tuesday, 17th of May, revealed an industry on the rise, with annual domestic gun production increasing from 3.9 million back in 2000 to 11.3 million in 2020. A relatively small percentage of guns produced domestically are exported overseas, so those numbers are an accurate reflection of gun buying habits, according to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms and Explosives officials. Currently, there are around 400 million guns in the United States, according to a 2018 survey conducted by the nonpartisan Small Arms Survey, which monitors gun ownership in the U.S. The statistics, culled by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms' Research Division from industry, academic and government experts, offered few major surprises. Many of the broader contours and conclusions have been widely known through other sources or anecdotally for months or even years. But the report's release nonetheless represents a significant victory for advocates of gun control in the United States. While Democrats have failed at the larger agenda of limiting easy access to firearms, especially semi-automatic rifles, they are succeeding in gradually pulling back an informational blackout curtain that has been obscured gun commerce data since George W. Bush's administration. A year ago, President Biden ordered the Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms, ATF, an undersized agency with the oversized task of enforcing the nation's gun laws and regulations, to collect and analyze 20 years of gun data after a series of mass shootings around the country. In the introduction to the report, Gary Restaino, the Bureau's interim director, wrote that the purpose of releasing the data was to prevent diversion of these firearms from the legal to the illegal market. During a White House summit about reducing violence on Tuesday, the Deputy Attorney General, Lisa Monaco, underlined a similar point, saying, "We can only address the current rise in violence if we have the best available information and use the most effective tools and research to fuel our efforts." Lisa Monaco's remarks came on the same day that President Joe Biden traveled to Buffalo, New York, to visit the scene of a racially motivated shooting on Saturday, 14th of May. Before boarding Air Force One, Joe Biden told reporters that he would redouble his efforts to convince Congress to enact gun control measures, but conceded that it will be difficult without a major shift in sentiment from lawmakers. The report, while eagerly anticipated, is considered less consequential than a coming analysis of weapons used to commit crimes, which will tap law enforcement, academic and public health sources to offer an equally comprehensive picture of trafficking patterns. It's important to know what the scope and size of the overall market is, and the Commerce report sheds light on that, said Nick Ciplina, a senior vice president with Everytown for Gun Safety, the gun control group founded by the former New York mayor, Michael Bloomberg. But the next logical step is to get the data on crime gun recoveries, to get that information back in the public sphere, so we can find out how these guns are going from legal manufacturing to illegal use, Mr. Ciplina added. That report is expected to highlight the role of illegal straw purchasers, legal buyers who sell weapons to people barred from purchasing handguns, and perhaps identify federally licensed dealers who are responsible for selling the greatest number of weapons later used in crimes. Some of that information has already made its way into the public domain. This month, the gun control group, Brady, released an examination of Pennsylvania firearms tracing data, revealing that six small retailers in South and Northeast Philadelphia sold more than 11,000 weapons that were later recovered in criminal investigations or confiscated from owners who had obtained them illegally from 2014 through to 2020. Over the past 2 years, gun thefts and from cars and homes have surged in major U.S. cities, fueling violent crime, according to an analysis by the Wall Street Journal. The gun industry has long resisted the disclosure of some firearms data collected by the ATF, the Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms. A series of Republican-sponsored measures pushed by the National Rifle Association, NRA, restricts officials at the Bureau from releasing trace data and other information to the public. The boom in gun production appears to have been partly driven by the expiration of the assault weapons ban in 2004. After the law was allowed to lapse, manufacture of types of semi-automatic rifles and pistols previously designated to the assault weapons steadily increased, particularly AR-type rifles and pistols, which are now commonly referred to as modern sporting rifles and modern sporting pistols, the report's authors found. Peyton Gendron, the suspect in the Buffalo, New York attack, used a Bushmaster semi-automatic rifle, one of many AR-15 clones available for legal purchases in the country. Two manufacturers are dominating the handgun market in the U.S., the report said. Smith & Wesson accounted for 8.2 million guns produced from 2016 to 2020, or 17% of the overall market. And Sturm, Roger & Company was closely behind, with nearly identical sales and production figures. The data compiled by the Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms covers a 20-year period. But the graphs included with the report show three periods of intense consumer volatility. One was in 2013, after the re-election of President Barack Obama and a mass shooting incident in Newtown, Connecticut, which prompted calls for increased gun regulations in the U.S. The second was in 2016, during the presidential campaign. The third unsettled period began in 2019 and extended through to 2020 election and pandemic. Gun production increased across the board during that time, but demand for semi-automatic handguns rose at the fastest rate on record, with pistol production rocketing from around 3 million to 5.5 million annually, the report found. The number of imported guns of all types has also been rising sharply, doubling from around 2 million per year a decade ago to more than 4 million per year in 2020, a record. Many of those were first-time buyers who flooded. The Bureau for Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms switchboard and email servers for information about how to buy a gun legally and which weapons were best for personal protection, one ATF official confirmed.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
English Radio, a herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hussain Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we're going to be looking at a very noble and informative and beautiful hadith, which has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam regarding the stability of states and what leads to governments and states being stable and lasting long, what causes their subsistence, or conversely, we can learn from this hadith, what leads to the downfall of governments and states. If they don't practice what the Imam has mentioned here, they will fall and they will terminate. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, "The greatest of the rights that the glorified Allah has made obligatory on man is the right of the ruler over the ruled and the right of the ruled over the ruler." So both the ruler and the ruled, they both have rights with respect to one another. In continuation, the Imam says, "So if the ruled, meaning the governed, the people, the masses, if they fulfill the rights of the ruler, and conversely, and the ruler fulfills their rights, the rights of the governed, the rights of his people, you know, then the truth attains the position of honor among them. The ways of religion become established, the marks of justice affirmed, the traditions and practices get implemented correctly, current times improve, the continuance of the state is desired, and the ambitions of the enemies are thwarted." So in this hadith, right, even though in the beginning of our program we mentioned this as the reasons for the stability of the states, in fact this is actually a hadith about the rights of rulers and the ruled. And what happens when both of these parties, these two parties in this transaction, you might say, when they follow there and observe each other's rights, what happens? One of the consequences and one of the benefits of this is that the government lasts long. It remains, it subsists. Nobody rebels against the government, right? You know, nobody rebels against the government, or no external force comes and, you know, kind of overthrows that government, right? But a lot of other effects and consequences have been mentioned here for this respect, this mutual respect that these two parties give to one another's rights, right? The justice is established, obviously. Traditions and practice gets implemented, yes. The times improve, obviously. Economic times, social, you know, maladies disappear, and these kind of things. The current times improve. You know, the ways of religion become established, yes. You know, so all of these are the effects and consequences of these, this respect that these two parties show one another. The final thing that the Imam mentions is that the continuance of the state is desired and the ambitions of the enemy thwarted, right? Because obviously one of the rights of this ruler is that the people support him if an external enemy comes and attacks, right? His right is that these people should protect the state, protect him and as well as the state, right? So if they follow his rights, obviously the ambitions of the enemies who seek to overthrow the government will be thwarted. That's probably why in another similar hadith, the Imam says, "Nothing fortifies states like justice." Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the reason for the stability of states in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
A white gunman has killed 10 people and wounded 3 others. 11 other people who